Let's take our Bibles this evening and open them to Acts chapter 11. And people say, are we ever going to get out of Acts 11? Well, you'll be heartened to learn that we're in Acts 11, verse 30, which means this is the last verse of the chapter. Wednesday evenings, we're continuing our verse-by-verse teaching through the book of Acts. We had that wonderful section, chapter 10, verse 1 through chapter 11, verse 18, concerning the conversion of Cornelius, the first full-fledged Gentile that got saved in the church age. And that section was followed up beginning in verse 19 through the end of Acts 11 on what the Lord was doing up north in Antioch, the church spreading from Jerusalem up north. And we talked about how Antioch is a big deal because it's from Antioch the three missionary journeys are going to be launched that are coming in chapter 13. So you can take that information about Antioch and you can divide it into two. You've got the development of the church in Antioch, verses 19 through 26, and how that church became a giving church. So you see their benevolence in verses 27 through 30. And that benevolence section, which we're almost finished, really begins with a prophecy that Agabus made. Agabus, along with Barnabas, came from Jerusalem to kind of investigate what was happening at Antioch. And Agabus predicted a famine all over the known world, verse 28. That would take place in the reign of Claudius. So the church at Antioch realized that the church in Jerusalem would suffer because of this. That was their mother church. It's like your mother in her older age. You don't want to neglect her. So that's how Antioch felt about Jerusalem, and they took up this collection to help the Jerusalemites, the Jerusalem saints in particular, because they knew that this famine was coming thanks to Agabus' prophecy. So Agabus' prophecy is described in verses 27 and 28, and the relief package, we can put it that way, is described in verses 29 through 30. The money is collected, verse 29, and now the money is sent, verse 30. So we pick it up there in verse 30, which I had hoped we would finish last week, but we didn't quite finish verse 30. But I didn't want to rush over it because there's some important stuff in that verse, just like there's important stuff in any verse of the Bible. It says, "And this they did, sending in charge of Barnabas and Saul and to the elders." So the money was delivered by Barnabas and Saul. You remember the last time we left Saul, he was in Tarsus at the end of chapter 9. And Barnabas went and got Saul and brought Saul. First of all, Barnabas was dispatched from Jerusalem to see what was happening in Antioch. Is this really a work of God or not? And Barnabas rejoiced that he saw the grace of God at work in Antioch, and considerable numbers were being brought to Christ. So Barnabas at that point finds Saul, who's still in Tarsus, and brings him to Antioch, and the two of them teach this giant flock of believers for over a year. And now it's Saul and Barnabas who are being dispatched from Antioch to go back to Jerusalem to deliver this relief package. So the money is sent through Saul, verse 30, and Barnabas, verse 30. And this, of course, reminds us of the qualifications of elders and deacons. We're going to get to elders in just a second. But Paul the Apostle, later in 1 Timothy chapter 3, is going to lay out the moral qualifications of being an elder or a deacon in a local church. And this is important for us because we, and I think we're getting close to doing that in this church, when people's terms are up, we accept nominations from the congregation, you know, concerning who would be a good elder or who would be a good deacon. And so, you know, who do you pick for those positions? You know, the person that's the best looking. I don't know if that would apply to our elder board per se, but maybe some of them. Do you pick the person that's the most popular? Do you pick the person that's the most successful in business? Well, what you'll discover is God is very clear concerning people you pick, and the qualifications are given in 1 Timothy 3, verses 8 through 13. And almost all of them, if not all of them, relate to character, Christ-like character. In fact, I don't even see talent. Our culture is so focused on talent. I don't even see talent as one of the criteria. The only thing it says about teaching is it says they have to be apt to teach. It doesn't even use the word charismata. They have to have the spiritual gift of teaching. They just have to be apt to teach. But as you peruse those verses, and you should because you're nominating people from the flock to the elder board, so you should know the kinds of people you look for. It says this of deacons. Deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued, meaning, you know, gossips or backstabbers or that kind of thing, or addicted to much wine. And then it says this, or fond of sordid gain. So you would not want a person in the position of deacon who has a weakness with money, because they're dealing with a lot of church money. I mean, our deacons are back there every Sunday counting money, recording donations, making sure funds get to where they're supposed to go. And you could imagine, and we have a policy, by the way, of two, not one, but two of them have to be in the room, you know, doing these distributions, calculations, all that kind of stuff. But you can imagine the disaster would be if you put someone in that position that had a weakness for materialism or material gain. It would be like a Judas situation, you know, where Judas had control of the money bag in the ministry of Jesus. And he used to help himself. We call that today embezzlement. You know, he used to help himself regularly to whatever was in there, he just took. And in fact, that's why he got upset when one of the sisters, you remember, began to pour expensive ointment on Christ. He basically said, and I think you'll find this in John 12, towards the beginning of the chapter, about verses 1 through 6, you know, he said this should have been, this ointment, this expensive oil should have been sold to the poor. Actually, it should have been sold, and the money should have been given to the poor. And then John adds this parenthetical comment. This he said, not because he cared about the poor, but because he was in charge of the money bag, and he used to steal what was in it. So he was just looking for more money to steal, and masqueraded his true motive as he cared for the poor. So that's the kind of situation you have if you don't have people of character in the position of deacon. But fortunately in this case, Saul is a man of character, Barnabas is a man of character, and so they're taking this contribution, this financial relief from Antioch back to the mother church in Jerusalem because of the famine that's coming that they're now aware of, thanks to Agabus's prophecy. And here's something that's very interesting that kind of gets overlooked by a lot of commentators. It says, Saul and Barnabas are taking the money from Antioch back to the elders in Jerusalem. Now, this is very interesting because this is the first use of the expression elders in the whole book of Acts relative to the church. So this is a key point of development as Luke is recording the birth and growth of the church. This is a key point of development in the leadership structure of the church. You know, what is the leadership of structure of the church supposed to look like? Well, you have your first clue here as those leaders in Jerusalem are referred to as elders. And basically any church that you go to today on the denominational landscape will have one of three models for church government. In other words, somebody has to make the final decision about all kinds of matters. The first model is called the Episcopalian model. That's the model that I grew up in, the Episcopalian church. It's what's called bishop rule. And it's the idea where a bishop kind of rules over multiple. In the Episcopalian denomination, they don't call them churches, but they call them parishes. So in the church that I grew up in, you know, there was a special chair set up for the bishop. And when he came, all the priests were always nervous and everything. And the bishop sat in this giant chair, you know, towards the middle of the building. And it was like a big deal. And my brother got into trouble because he was an acolyte and he sat prematurely in the bishop's chair as a little kid and got kind of chewed out by the priest. But that's called basically the Episcopalian model. Every model claims scriptural support. The Episcopalian model claims Acts 15 because they say that the decision that was made in Acts 15 affected all the churches. The only problem with using Acts 15 is Acts 15 is talking about the apostles. And I don't think we have any apostles today. If you are an apostle, tell me how you keep yourself looking so young, because you should be about 2,000 years old by now, looking at what the biblical criteria are for an apostle that we've already studied in Acts 1. It's basically someone that had to have seen the risen Christ. The second model is called the congregational model, where the seat of authority is in the congregation. So there's perpetual votes and all of these kinds of things, and majority rule. You know, kind of like how America is set up. It's the people that are supposed to be the monarchs sort of thing, and what the people want goes. And this group claims Acts 6, verses 1 through 7 for support, where a decision was made by the apostles, but it says in Acts 6, verses 1 through 7, and this deals with the distribution of food to widows. It says this decision pleased the whole congregation. And so they derive from that you can't go forward with a decision in the church unless the congregation votes for it or backs it up. I mean, and the problem with what they're doing with Acts 6 is it doesn't say the authority rested with the congregation. It just says they happened to, in this instance, you know, agree with what the apostles were doing, but they had really no, you read through Acts 6, they really had no authority to veto what the apostles were doing. But that's the congregational rule verses that are used. You know, the basic problem with congregational rule is if the purpose of the church is to lead the flock to maturity, which is what its purpose is, Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 16, then you've got a scenario where, as I like to call it, the inmates are running the asylum. Let's just put it that way. The prisoners, pardon me for these crass analogies, is the only thing that come to mind. You know, the prisoners are running, the inmates are running the prison. In other words, you're putting people that are in a state of immaturity to be led into maturity in position of authority over those leading the flock into maturity. So it's like a parent taking orders from their child kind of thing. And so that's really the problem with congregational rule. And then there's the last model here, which I think is the one that has the best biblical support. And you're in a church, Sugarland Bible Church, that follows this last model. It's basically elder rule. I threw the word Presbyterian in there, but don't let that sidetrack you. The word elder in Greek is presbyteros, if I have that right. And basically, it's this idea that a congregation is governed by a plurality of godly men. It doesn't say anywhere how many elders you have to have, but it does indicate a plurality of elders. And we think that that's really the form of church government that has the best biblical support. So Acts 20, verse 17, for example, when Paul, on his third missionary journey, stopped off at Miletus and summoned the leadership of the church at Ephesus to instruct them, it says in Acts 20, verse 17, from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called to him the elders of the church. So there was a plurality of godly men that were governing the church at Ephesus. And in that same context, they're called overseers. I've got on the screen there Acts 20, verse 28. Let me get my pen functioning here. Acts 20, verse 28. And it says of those that are called elders, verse 17, verse 28, be on your guard, as Paul is instructing them, for yourselves and for all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. So these elders were overseers of the church at Ephesus, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Now notice of these overseers or elders, it says which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. So that's sort of the criteria that we use as on the elder board when someone's term is ending. If you read our constitution, elders are not in that position forever. They rotate terms, and so we have to fill vacancies. And so we try to lay hands on the people that we think God would want in those positions. And so one of the things we do as elders is we just, when terms are continuing and we don't have an immediate need for a replacement, we just look at the flock and see, you know, who is functioning as an elder already without the title. So we try to look at what God is doing through a person, through a man, and then that's the person we want to pick for leadership. So we want to pick those that God has picked and not kind of, you know, grab somebody and jam them into leadership, whether God wants them there or not, because I've been in situations where churches do that, and it has a tendency to be very, very disastrous. So this is what you call the elder led elder rule model. 1 Timothy 4:14 says, do not neglect the spiritual gift within you, which was bestowed on you through prophetic utterance. with the laying of hands by the presbytery. There's your word for elder. So Timothy became a pastor because he had a particular gift for it, and it was recognized by the elders of the church, and they laid hands on him and put him in the position that he went into as pastor over the church at Ephesus. That same word, presbytery, is translated as eldership in the New King James Version in 1 Timothy 4:14. So I'm just trying to show you that this elder-led philosophy is not something that we came up with. I don't know of anyone who would design their business that way. Usually you have a CEO who's in charge of everything, maybe answering to a board of some kind. But that's really not the model that we have. It's equality among peers. Even though I'm probably the most visible elder, because I'm the pastor, teacher, slash elder, I have no more voting power than anybody else on the elder board. I'm one currently of six. And they're the ones that set my salary. I don't set my own salary. In fact, our Constitution says, you know, when they make salary decisions, the person that's benefiting or not benefiting is supposed to leave the room while the others vote. So, and I think that's wise. And the way our accounting is set up is the senior pastor has basically no knowledge, and I'm not even sure our elder board has a knowledge of this, of who gives what. The only thing we really see, or I see personally, is a big budget, how much comes in financially, but I have no knowledge of who gives what, who's a big donor, who's a little donor, who's in between. I have no knowledge of that. And I kind of like that because it allows me to be an equal opportunity offender. I could just offend anybody, you know. If I knew who was given the big bucks, if anyone is, I would, you know, kind of, you know, kiss up to them a little bit or something. But our accounting system wisely is set up so that that kind of thing is avoided. So this idea of elder-led is, we think it's biblical. And I'm just giving you the verses that support it. Here's another one. I've got it on the screen there. 1 Timothy 5:17. Boy, this is being really stubborn today. I know there's another way to get rid of these things up here, but I'm not having a lot of success. 1 Timothy 5:17 says, "The elders who rule well are to be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching." I like that. But it says elders. And there's a distinction between ruling elders and teaching elders. And the elders that rule well, they're not to be, you know, maligned behind their back. They're to be honored, and it says especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. Oh my goodness, it turned green. Learning all kinds of things up here. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 19 says, "Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of 2 to 3 witnesses." So that becomes important, because if an elder steps out of line or does something immoral and someone says, "I saw elder so-and-so do such-and-such," our response is, well, do you have your 2 to 3 witnesses lined up? You cannot convict an elder, accuse of an elder biblically without 2 to 3 witnesses. And that's good, because it protects elders from the rumor mill and just people running around and spreading rumors about elders with no basis in fact. But it also reveals that elders are not untouchable. Elders can be removed from their positions on the basis of immoral conduct, as is evidenced by 2 to 3 witnesses. Titus 1 verse 5 says this of elders, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you." So the first thing you need to do, Timothy, on the island of Crete, as you're trying to bring these house churches under control, is you need to appoint elders in each of those house churches. So that was the first thing that Paul told Timothy to do as he was overseeing a whole bunch of house churches on the island of Crete. 1 Peter 5, verses 1 through 4 says, "Therefore I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, a partaker of the glory that is to be revealed, to shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, not as yet lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory." So elders, if you do your job well, you're not in it for sordid gain. You're not in it because it meets some kind of psychological need in your life or power or something. But you're doing it for the right reason. When the chief shepherd appears, he'll give you a crown for a job well done. So you notice that elders are nothing more than under shepherds, Jesus being the ultimate shepherd of the sheep. And he has under shepherds called elders, which is what elders are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be shepherding the flock of God. If you want to know what an elder is supposed to do, all you have to do is look at the function of a shepherd in the natural world. A shepherd in the natural world, as he's shepherding sheep, basically does three things. He guides the sheep. He grazes the sheep, meaning he feeds the sheep. And then he guards the sheep, protecting the sheep from false doctrine, protecting the sheep from things as simple as, or as complicated as, you put your kids in a nursery and there's no pedophiles in the nursery, which is a big problem in the church world. Pedophiles, those that want to have sex with children, love the church world because there's a lot of, you know, unguarded children in the church world. And so obviously, as elders, we would try to keep all that nonsense out of here, physically protect the sheep. That's why we have a policy, you know, whereas if you want to work in the nursery, not only do you have to have a pass a background check, but there has to be two of you as workers in the nursery. So we don't allow unvetted people, unsupervised people into the nursery. So that's I would put that under the category of guarding the sheep. When the Muslims come in here, as they've tried to do a couple of times since I've been here, and they want to give out their gift bags that look identical to our gift bags, by the way, for newcomers. Maybe we shouldn't call them gift bags, visitors' bags. And instead of a copy of the Bible in there or John's Gospel in there, they want to put a copy of the Quran in there. And they want to come into the parking lot and sometimes come into the building during church time, and they want to invite you to their cultural center. "Oh, we've got wonderful, you know, finger painting and face painting for the kids. Come over and we'll put a happy face on Islam for you." That's where elders, you know, doing their job, would stand up and say, "Thanks, but no thanks. We're not interested." That's just an example of guarding the flock from physical harm, from spiritual harm. And then, of course, grazing is feeding the flock, which is hopefully what I'm doing here by, you know, teaching the Bible verse by verse. You know, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by everything that proceeds from the mouth of God." So that's a biblical understanding of what elders are. And sometimes that gets lost because a lot of the things you talk about in elder meetings are business related, finance related, those kind of issues. Are we going to do a building project or not do a building project? You know, those kinds of things. And it's easy to see people's business mentality kind of take over, you know, which is nice. And you get, kind of get the idea that an elder is really a top-notch business person. And that really is not what the Bible teaches. An elder basically is a shepherd. And a shepherd basically does three things. He guards, he grazes, he guides. And so we try to function according to a plurality of elders, meaning it's not one person's will that controls the elder board. The issue comes up and we look for a meeting of the minds amongst the elders. And I think, you know, it's worked fairly good here since the time I've been here, at least since 2010. And there are a lot of churches that reject this. I know of one major movement. They totally reject elder rule and they put the pastor in control of everything. And you ask them for biblical support for that, and they call it the Moses method or the Moses mentality. You know, where Moses was making decisions for the whole nation of Israel. 1.5 million people, supposedly, roughly, coming out of the Egyptian, 400 years of Egyptian bondage. I mean, Moses was the guy. And so a lot of pastors say, well, you know, this church is it's not a democracy, it's a theocracy, and my name's Theo, so to speak. And they kind of put themselves in a position where they're in charge of the whole church. And you ask them for biblical support, and the only thing they can give you is something that's 1,500 years before the time of Christ. They don't have support in the New Testament, which governs the church age for it. So it's a method that really has no biblical support. And maybe it works well in some circumstances, but the issue isn't what works well. The issue is, what does the Bible reveal? So what you're seeing here develop for the very first time is elder rule, as this money is being sent from Barnabas and Saul in Antioch back to the elders of the church at Jerusalem. Now, here's what is very, very interesting. When we have seen leadership of the church at the Church of Jerusalem before, we have not seen that church ruled by elders. We have seen it ruled by apostles. For example, they made a big decision concerning the appointment of deacons in Acts 6. Verses 1 through 7, and the guys that made that decision are called the 12. Acts 6, verse 2. Acts 6, verse 6, they're called the apostles. There was 12 of them. And they made a decision to appoint 7 men, who later, as we explained back in Acts 6, became deacons. So why is it then that if the apostles are making decisions for the church at Jerusalem, why is it here that the gift is sent from Antioch through Barnabas and Saul? Why is it sent to the elders of the church at Jerusalem? Shouldn't it say apostles? Well, what you're starting to see here in the book of Acts is God is phasing out apostles. The gift of apostleship was not designed to last forever. Eventually, the ball, so to speak, had to be handed off to another leadership structure called the elders. So what you're watching here in the book of Acts is a transition from apostles to elders over the Jerusalem church. And that fits very well with what the Apostle Paul says about apostles. He will later say in the book of Ephesians, chapter 2, verse 20, concerning the church, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Christ Jesus being the cornerstone. So when he uses this expression, wow, look at that. I've even changing colors here. I really need to get this thing down. Well, that didn't help either. I'm going to have to come in here for like a practice session or something, because maybe some of my art people, Laura, can help me. But when he makes the point that the church was built on the foundation of the apostles, let me ask you a question. How many times in a building structure do you lay a foundation? You lay it one time. And that's what you're seeing here in the book of Acts. I mean, the whole church got off the ground through the apostles. I mean, they're the key decision makers in Acts, but now the money is being sent back to the elders. The first time we see the word elders in the book of Acts, so what is happening is the foundational gift of apostleship is starting to fade away and pave the way for the governing structure over congregations that we know of today called elders. So backing up just a little bit, when we make decisions as elders at Sugarland Bible Church, we're not doing it as bishops. We're not making decisions for other churches. We have had people come here and ask our advice on different things, but it's just advice. It has no authority to control another or to have any influence, binding influence, I should say, over another flock. They're going to have to make up their own decisions because we reject the bishop rule model. When we make decisions as elders, we would certainly consult the congregation. I mean, that's just common sense. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? But when it comes to a final decision, it's not the congregation that makes that decision. It's the elders. I think there might be one exception to that in the constitution of the Sugarland Bible Church related to debt. We can't go into debt without congregational approval, and that's what our constitution says. But other than that, it's elders that make the primary decisions, listening to the voice of the congregation, but understanding that it's not the congregation that has the final say. We don't believe in a theocracy in the sense that the pastor controls everything, because there's no biblical support for that other than Moses, which is a different dispensation entirely. That's the nation of Israel under law. We're not in that dispensation. We're in the church age. But we do believe that the local church, Sugarland Bible Church, should be governed by a plurality. Bible doesn't say how many necessarily, of godly men, you know, seeking a common mind through prayer about different decisions. So I hope you found a little of that helpful. You'll notice that the money was not sent to judges, kings, patriarchs, prophets, or tribes. I mean, why wasn't the money sent to judges, kings, patriarchs, prophets, tribes, etc.? Because that's how Israel functioned. The church is not Israel. The church is a new man. It's a not even a nation. It's a spiritual man, and it has a completely different leadership structure. And that leadership structure is the plurality of godly men on the elder, so-called elder board. So with all that being said, let's transition. I can't even use that word transition anymore today, can I? What's another word I could use? Let's move on. How's that? To chapter 12. And here we're dealing with the fourth persecution of the Jerusalem church. So the church at Jerusalem has already been persecuted a number of times by the leadership structure of unbelieving national Israel. This happened in chapter 3. This happened in chapters 4 and 5. This happened again in chapter 8. And now here we are in chapter 12, and it's happening all over again. And this time the unbelieving Israel structure is going to go after not a deacon, Stephen, remember, the first martyr of the church age. They're not going to go after the Christian Jewish population in general, but they're going to actually try to take out two apostles. The first apostle they're going to kill, his name is James. And the second apostle they're going to throw in prison, his name is Peter. And so we pick it up here, verses 1 and 2, with James' death. And we have a guy named Herod in control. We have his goal, and we have his victim. And I'm in chapter 12 and verse 1. It says, "Now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them." So you notice this expression here, "now at that time." So the reader is supposed to contrast what's happening in chapter 12 with what just happened in chapter 11. Chapter 11 is a beautiful picture of the church at Antioch. Chapter 12 is a horrific picture of unbelieving Israel. And so you're supposed to contrast those two. Because what God is doing in the book of Acts is he's raising up the church and he's laying aside for a season the nation of Israel. In fact, the nation of Israel, having rejected their king nationally, is going to get worse and worse and worse. Not that some Jews don't get saved, many are. I'm talking about nationally and leadership-wise, it's going to get worse and worse and worse, culminating in the divine discipline of AD 70. Which will take place right after the book of Acts closes, where Titus of Rome will sack Jerusalem and push the nation of Israel into worldwide dispersion. Why that dispersion is coming is highlighted by the guilt of the nation, not just having rejected their king, Jesus Christ, but rejecting his church. And that spiritual callousness is supposed to be contrasted with the love and the beauty and the growth of the church at Antioch. So that's why it says, "now at that time." So what we have here is kind of a general goal of persecuting the church. The guy orchestrating this is King Herod. He is a member of the Herodian dynasty. The Herodian dynasty is the dynasty that you see in power all the way through the Gospels and into the book of Acts. They're basically puppets of Rome. Rome, the occupying power, sort of keeping control over the nation of Israel through this puppet regime, so to speak, called the Herodian dynasty. The Herods were not pure Jews. They were partly, or they were Edomite, really, coming from Esau. And they're the people that were in power to sort of function as puppets of Rome to keep the nation of Israel under control. And so the particular Herod that's in power here is a guy named Herod Agrippa I, who was a grandson of Herod the Great, the Herod that is in power in the life of Christ. Now we have a different Herod in this Herodian dynasty, Herod Agrippa I. And he basically wants to persecute and mistreat, it says, the church. The church, of course, are those people, primarily Jewish at this point, who have trusted in Yeshua for personal salvation, the very Savior that the nation of Israel nationally rejected. So Herod's goal is, I want to mistreat these people. I want to persecute them. And he has a particular victim in mind. His name is James. You see it in verse 2. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. The New Testament is a little tricky because there's four James of prominence that we know of in the New Testament. Here's Acts 1, 13 and 14, where it lists all four James. First of all, there was John and James. And then there was another James, the son of Alphaeus. And there was another James, the son of Judas, not the Judas you're thinking of, Judas Iscariot, a different Judas. And then Jesus had two half-brothers, right? At least two half-brothers. They weren't full brothers because Jesus was born of a virgin, right? But following the virgin birth of Jesus, Mary and Joseph had a normal marital sexual relationship. And from that union came forth what we call the half-brothers of Jesus Christ, sharing the same mother, but obviously not the same father, because Jesus was virgin born. And two of them wrote New Testament books, and those are James and Jude. And I think there was a few others of them as well. Of course, the Roman Catholics don't want you to know about these half-brothers because they want you to believe in the perpetual virginity of Mary, that she just stayed a virgin her whole life. Well, that's false doctrine. The Bible doesn't teach that. Surely she was a virgin at the time of Christ's conception and birth, but she did not stay a virgin her whole life, or else where did these half-brothers come from? So the two James in the middle there are not the James we're talking about here that was killed. His brothers at the very end there, James and Jude, the half-brothers, are not the James we're talking about here. But the James that we're talking about here that was martyred by Herod Agrippa is the first James that I have underlined. It says, when they entered the city, they went up to the upper room and they were staying where they were staying. That is Peter and John and James. So this particular James is the brother of John, the son of Zebedee. And the two of them were called the sons of thunder. And so I guess this particular James was pretty aggressive. He was one of the original 12. The two in the middle are kind of lesser known James. We don't really hear much about them as we continue through the New Testament. And of course, we're not dealing with the half-brother of Christ, James, because he's going to write an epistle about AD 44, which comes later. But we're dealing with John's brother, the son of Zebedee, one of the sons of thunder. That's the one that Herod Agrippa took out. He was part of the inner circle, the James that was martyred. The inner circle of Jesus consisted of Peter, James, and John. They're always together in the Gospels. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Matthew 17, verse 1, it says, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them on a high mountain by themselves. So the three of them were always together with Jesus. Two of them brothers. Throw Peter into the mix. You've got this inner circle. And so that's the James that's killed here by Herod Agrippa. And it's kind of interesting. There was a prophecy given about them, those sons of thunder. It says in Matthew 20, verses 20 through 23, the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, that would be James and John, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" And she said to him, "Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and one on your left." Sounds like a typical mother, right? Dare I say a typical Jewish mother. "Hey, when you bring in your kingdom, I want my two sons, James and John, I want them seated on either side of you." Pretty bold request. But Jesus answered, "You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the cup that I am able to drink?" They said, "We are able." So Jesus lays down a principle that first comes the cross, then comes the crown. If you want a position of prominence and authority in the millennial kingdom, are you willing to suffer what I'm going to suffer? And the two sons say, "Yeah, no problem. We're able." And Jesus says something very interesting in response. Matthew 20, verse 23. He said to them, "My cup you will drink." "Hey, are you able to suffer with me?" "No problem." Jesus turns around and says, "You will." "But to sit on my right and my left, that is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared by my Father." So, are you willing to drink the cup that I'm going to drink from, the cup of suffering? "No problem." And Jesus turns around and says, "You will." So, when he turns around and says, "You will," I think it's a prediction of what would happen to one of the brothers, James. James would suffer martyrdom. And that's a prophecy that was fulfilled not long after Jesus made the statement, right here in Acts chapter 12 and verse 2. So this is not the first martyrdom. Stephen was the first martyrdom, Acts 7. But this is the first martyr of an actual apostle. We know from Acts 8 and verse 1 that the apostles stayed in Jerusalem primarily. When Saul of Tarsus brought persecution against the church in Acts 8. It says in Acts 8 verse 1, Saul was in hearty agreement with putting him to death. This is pre-conversion Saul. "And on that day, great persecution began against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles." So that's why the apostles are still in Jerusalem to be martyred by Herod Agrippa I. So we're not dealing here with a general persecution anymore. Acts 8 verse 4 talks about a general persecution. "Therefore those who had been scattered went about preaching the word." Verse 3, "But Saul began ravaging the church, entering house after house, dragging off men and women. He would put them in prison." Acts 11, verse 19 sort of picks up on this, and it says, "Those who were scattered because of persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia, Cyprus, Antioch, speaking the word to no one except to the Jews alone." So what we've seen so far is the martyrdom of a deacon, Acts 7. We've seen general persecution, but we haven't seen anything like this yet, where the leader of the Herodian dynasty just took out an apostle. And so what Luke is developing for us is Israel's hatred for the things of Jesus Christ nationally is getting worse and worse and worse, which is going to explain why God is going to lead them into discipline in AD 70. And God never leaves the earth without a witness of himself, so he's raising up the church. Not to permanently replace Israel, or else we'd be teaching replacement theology. Israel in the future will come back into the fold. But in the meantime, Israel is under discipline. Israel has been in time out, shall we say, for the last 2,000 years. Under the rod of divine discipline, which is what God said would happen, going back to the Mosaic law in Deuteronomy 28. But God doesn't leave the earth without a witness of himself, so he's raising up the church as his witnesses, those who have trusted in the very Messiah that national Israel rejected. So James dies. And the second thing that happens in this chapter is Peter doesn't die, but he's thrown in prison. So now Herod Agrippa I is going after apostle number two. And so we see Peter's arrest there in verse 3. Look at verse 3 of Acts chapter 12. When he, that's Herod Agrippa I, saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. So Herod Agrippa I has a motive. He saw that when he killed James, it pleased the Jewish population. And one of the things to understand about the Herodian dynasty, because they were partially Edomite and half-breeds, and really puppets of Rome when you get right down to it, they were very insecure over their own throne. Herod Agrippa I, like all of the Herods, had a real insecurity problem. I mean, you see that with Herod the Great, right? In the Christmas story, when the Magi came from Babylon, we've come to worship the king, and Herod wanted to know, where is the king? Because I'm the king. And he located Bethlehem as the place where the infant was so he could murder him and all of the innocents in Bethlehem. I mean, he was very insecure over his own throne, as was his grandson, Herod Agrippa I. And part of that insecurity related to the fact that Israel is supposed to have a king over them that's one of their own. Not an Edomite. Not a half-breed. Deuteronomy 17 verse 15 says, "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your own countrymen you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman." So if you want to have a king, he's got to be just like you, Jewish. And here's a guy that's Edomite. So he was always nervous that the Jews were going to revolt against him, take his power away, and just like Herod the Great was nervous about that as well. So he's always trying to make the Jews happy. And here we see his motive. He decides to take out Peter because he saw how happy it made the rest of the Jews. Boy, we're so happy you killed James. And Herod says, okay, I'm going to keep making him happy, because I'm afraid they might turn on me, because I'm not fully Israeli, and I like being the king. So I'll take out the second apostle in the church. Second apostle in the church is a guy named Peter. So Peter is arrested. By the way, when it says it pleased the Jews, that's showing you the guilt of first century Israel. This is why God is about ready to send Israel into discipline and raise up the church in Israel's place for a season during the church age. When he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. So now Peter is arrested. He is the second apostle persecuted. First apostle persecuted is James, one of the sons of thunder. Now Peter is not martyred as was James, but he's thrown in prison. Now this is going to be Peter's third time in prison in the book of Acts. I mean, the guy's in and out of prison all the time. Acts 4 verse 3. They laid hands on them and put them in jail until the next day, for it was already evening. Acts 5, verse 18. They laid hands on the apostles and put them in jail. Now for Peter, it's round 3. And notice the timing of this. Verse 3, now it was during the days of unleavened bread. So here are Israel's feasts, going back to Leviticus 23. 4 in the spring, 3 in the fall. You can see where these feasts fall on Israel's calendar. And you can see what Israel's months of the calendar look like compared to our months of the year. But essentially the way it worked is there was Passover, commemorating what happened in Exodus 12, Exodus 11, etc., with the Passover lamb. And then there was 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So he was waiting for Passover to run its course. He was waiting for the Feast of Unleavened Bread to run its course. Because, I mean, who wants to kill somebody during a feast, right? And then he was going to present Peter to the Jews and say, kind of like with Barabbas and Jesus, you know, what shall I do with this man? And he was trying to make the Jews happy because he saw how happy they got when James was martyred. So let's let the Passover run its course. Let's let the Feast of Unleavened Bread run its course. We'll just keep Peter, you know, sort of incarcerated for a little while, a few days. When those few days run their course, then I'll bring him out and I'll make the Jews happy because I know what they're going to say. They're going to say, kill him just like you did James. And then you have the incarceration of Peter described in verse 4. Let me try to cover verse 4 and then we'll call it a night. It says, when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to 4 squads of soldiers to guard him. Now, a couple of things. The incarceration is described, 4 squads of soldiers. What does that mean? It means 4 soldiers for each 6-hour shift. Every 6-hour shift, you get a new set of soldiers, meaning a total of 16 soldiers were guarding Peter around the clock. 2 of them were chained to Peter, and 2 were standing guard either inside or outside the prison door. So this is like overkill. And why are they putting Peter under such harsh circumstances? Well, Peter's a guy that got out of jail before. And I have a tendency to believe that Herod Agrippa I knew about that. Acts 5, verse 19, it says, during the night, the angel of the Lord opened the gates of the prison, taking them out. So Herod Agrippa says, we're not going to let that happen again. So we've got these 16 soldiers, 4 soldiers for each 6-hour shift, guarding Peter around the clock. And as they're guarding him, Herod Agrippa I is delaying the sentence of Peter. He's in prison, but he hasn't been killed yet like James. Although Herod Agrippa I, his intention is to kill Peter. And you see that in the second part of verse 4, where it says, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So after the Passover, after the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, then I'll bring him out and the Jews will say, kill him, just like you did James. And that will make me popular with the Jews because I can see how happy it made them when I killed James. And my own throne that I really shouldn't be on anyway because I'm not fully Jewish, but an Edomite, I can keep my throne. So this sets the stage for one of the greatest miracles in the Bible, a prison escape. And we're not dealing with escape from Alcatraz or something like that. We're dealing with the intervention of the angel of the Lord. And so we'll pick it up there in verse 5. By the way, what is the church doing as this catastrophe is happening? They're picketing and petitioning, right? They're sending emails. They're on social media talking about how unfair it is. No, they're in prayer. They're in prayer. And boy, do their prayers get answered. So we'll pick it up there with verse 5. So I went 5 minutes over. Apologize for that, but we'll see y'all next week. Unless you want to stick around for Q&A. So now's a good time to collect your young ones, etc., if you want to do that. Bill. And those that want to stick around for Q&A, we can do that as well.